This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hi, I'm Alex Ritson, and on the Global News podcast, we're following reports a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza is at last within reach. We're told a draft text is being studied by negotiators from both sides in Qatar, although there is still no shortage of sceptics. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. There is breaking news from South Korea this hour, where investigators are once again trying to arrest the country's suspended president, Yoon Suk-yeol. We hope to join our correspondent there at what is just after six in the morning very soon. In the meantime, the man that Donald Trump wants to be the next US Defense Secretary has been at the center of a long and raucous hearing of the Armed Services Committee in Washington today. The former soldier and one-time Fox News TV host, Pete Hegseth, has denied claims of excessive drinking, sexism and sexual misconduct. In his opening statement, he told senators for and against his appointment that he'd been asked by President-elect Donald Trump to change the culture of the Pentagon.
When President Trump chose me for this position, the primary charge he gave me was to bring the warrior culture back to the Department of Defense. He, like me, wants a Pentagon laser-focused on lethality, meritocracy, warfighting, accountability, and readiness.
Pete Hegseth being cut off there by one of several hecklers who broke in as he spoke before being removed from the room. The chairman of the committee, Republican Senator Roger Wicker, said claims of misconduct made against Mr. Hegseth had been exaggerated.
Regarding his personal conduct, Mr. Hegseth has admitted to falling short, as we all do from time to time. It is noteworthy that the vast majority of the accusations leveled at Mr. Hegseth have come from anonymous sources. Contrast these anonymous accusations with the many public letters of support and commendation.
Well, in a supporting role, Republican Senator Dan Sullivan put this question to Pete Hegseth.
If confirmed and you issued an order saying we are going to rip the Biden woke yoke off the neck of our military and focus on lethality and warfighting, how do you think the troops will react?
Senator, I know the troops will rejoice.
They will love it.
They will love it. And we've already seen it in recruiting numbers. There's already been a surge since President Trump won the election.
In a testy exchange, the Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen confronted Mr. Hegseth with previous comments he'd made, saying that women in combat roles were weakening the U.S. military.
Why should women in our military, if you were the Secretary of Defense, believe that they would have a fair shot and an equal opportunity to rise through the ranks? If on the one hand, you say that women are not competent, they make our military less effective, and on the other hand, you say, oh no, now that I've been nominated to be the Secretary of Defense, I've changed my view on women in the military. What do you have to say to the almost 400,000 women who are serving today about your position on whether they should be capable to rise through the highest ranks of our military?
Senator, I would say I would be honored to have the opportunity to serve alongside you, shoulder to shoulder, men and women, black, white, all backgrounds, with a shared purpose.
So how rough a ride was this confirmation hearing? Julia Manchester is political reporter for the US news website The Hill in Washington. He didn't look phased. Was he expecting, I asked her, all that had been thrown at him?
Yes, this was expected. We knew that obviously Republicans on the committee were going to praise him. It would be relatively smooth sailing with Republicans, though all eyes certainly on Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, who has been considered a bit of a holdout on the nomination, questionable as to which way she will vote. But for Democrats, they certainly were expected to go after Pete Hegseth, and they certainly did on a number of issues. We heard Senator Richard Blumenthal, for example, from Connecticut, say that he would trust Pete Hegseth to be a Pentagon spokesperson, but didn't believe he had the ability or experience to lead the massive bureaucracy that is the U.S. Department of Defense. You saw a number of female senators like Jean Shaheen, Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, press him on his past comments about women serving in the military and women having combat roles and his sort of 180 on that issue. And then, of course, you had senators across the board on the Democratic side really grill Hegseth over those sexual misconduct allegations he has faced. So Democrats know that they likely won't be able to sink his nomination unless a Republican votes against it or multiple Republicans vote against it. But this is a Democrat's chance really to present Pete Hegseth or spin Pete Hegseth in a negative light to Americans who are watching this unfold in real time.
And was there Republican criticism of Mr. Hegseth? There was plenty of time for it.
There was time for it, I should say. But for the most part, Republicans have seemed to have fallen in line with Pete Hegseth. Like I said, Joni Ernst, the senator from Iowa, she herself is a veteran, serves on the Armed Services Committee, talked about her work with Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat who also serves on the Armed Services Committee. You know, her questioning was certainly tough, but it wasn't anything like he was getting from the Democratic side of the aisle. You know, our sources have told us that someone like Hegseth has really improved his standing, among Republican lawmakers over the past 2 months. Remember when he was nominated for the position, it took a lot of people off guard. Pete Hegseth was at the time a Fox News weekend host, the host of Fox and Friends, a sort of conservative-leaning light morning TV show. He is a combat veteran and has that experience, but he doesn't have experience leading bureaucracies, working in the government. So there was a lot of skepticism initially, but it seems as if the Republicans on the Senate side have come around to him.
So what happens next? And do you think he's done enough to get approved as next U.S. Defense Secretary?
There will likely be some lobbying behind closed doors still. There might be some Republican senators, very few, I would say, but, some like Susan Collins, for example, Lisa Murkowski, senators that are normally swing votes when it comes to these confirmations. I imagine that people from the Trump transition team, including Hegseth, will continue to meet and talk with them. So I would imagine there's going to be that lobbying. But remember, Hegseth is one of numerous Trump cabinet nominees that need to go through this confirmation process. We have former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, who will begin her confirmation process tomorrow for Attorney General. She's expected to sail through, but there's other contentious picks, or controversial picks, I should say, like Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence and Kash Patel for FBI Director, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for Health and Human Services Secretary, that have received a somewhat rocky reception, definitely from Democrats, but also a little bit from Republicans.
Julia Manchester, political reporter for the US news website The Hill, speaking to us there from Washington, D.C. Live now to South Korea, where investigators are trying once again to arrest the country's suspended president, Yoon Suk-yeol. He is facing charges of insurrection and abuse of power after he briefly imposed martial law in December. The president's security team thwarted an attempt by the police to arrest him on the 3rd of January. The police are back in much greater force now, trying to arrest him again. Shaima Khalil joins us live from outside the presidential residence in the capital, Seoul. Shaima, this is more or less a dawn raid, isn't it? What's happening?
Well, there is before a dawn raid, and you wouldn't feel it here because the crowds have been building up on both sides, anti-Yoon and pro-Yoon protesters on the outside barricades of the presidential compound. I'm looking at dozens and dozens of police officers, and we're actually very close to the last police barricade that then leads into an alleyway that leads to the entrance of the presidential compound. And just before we came on air, there was a surge of tension because a group of ruling party lawmakers made their way through that police barricade, and a large huddle of anti-Yoon protesters. Essentially, what they tried to do and succeeded is get through that police barricade and then station themselves outside the presidential compound gates, putting themselves as a human chain, if you will. And there was about, we understand there's about 25 of them between themselves and between the investigators who, we understand, handed them the arrest warrant, made the argument that they had a legal reason to be here, and urged them to allow them to make the arrest. What I'm looking at now is also a huge screen of a local media channel, and it is showing a police car trying to make their way through the main gate unsuccessfully. We also hear a surge of chants by anti-Yoon protester every time we hear news from local media that police are trying to make their way in through multiple entries. So far, they've been blocked by the president's security team like last time. The last time they tried this, the investigators as well as the police officers, they were much smaller numbers of them, and they were blocked for 6 hours by the police. By the presidential security team. Right now, they're in bigger numbers. They're managing to control the crowds outside. They've barricaded the area outside. What they have not managed to do yet is get inside the presidential compound, get anywhere close to the president, let alone make that arrest. That is what they're trying to do, and it's unclear if they're going to be successful this time round.
If they're not successful, Shaima, what would happen?
They're expecting the standoff, we understand, to last a few days. They say that we're going to try this today, tomorrow, and the day after. And if they're unsuccessful, they go back to the drawing board. I think last time it was quite embarrassing for them, but I also think it was quite telling at the deep political crisis and the deep division, not just in politics, but in power, really, that South Korea finds itself in. And you do see it now. It's not just about the protesters on both sides. It's the fact that you've got law enforcement officers in the police and in the investigators. And I'm just looking at a group of police officers now, dozens of them rushing in the direction of the entrance of the presidential compound, saying that they have a legal arrest warrant that they need to execute for a president that has been suspended, that has been stripped of his power. And then you've got a security team for that president who also argue their side and say they're also following their orders for protecting that president. And that brings up the question, well, who calls the shots? Who's in power? And this is unanswered. And today, you also have this scene where the lawmakers of the ruling party are also standing in the way. This standoff could last for hours, it could last for days, but what you're guaranteed is more political instability for South Korea.
And briefly, how is all this political turmoil being viewed by the country's neighbours, particularly North Korea?
Well, North Korea fired a missile yesterday. It was viewed as something that would happen prior to the inauguration of President Trump. But I also think that this is concerning, not just for domestic politics in South Korea, but the fact that beyond its borders, on the other side of the world, this was seen as a stable democracy, somewhat an ally of the United States that it could depend on, especially with an over-assertive North Korea. Right now, it's in political turmoil, and this is going to worry a lot of people beyond South Korea's borders.
Shaima Khalil amid the crowds outside the presidential residence in Seoul, in South Korea. BBC World Service, this is NewsHour. Coming up shortly, we hear from a firefighter pilot helping to put out fires in California. And we're looking at BBC News, and indirect talks between Hamas and Israel are going on in Qatar, as all parties involved say a ceasefire for a deal and the relative release of hostages is closer than ever. One other news headline for now. Investigators in South Korea are trying to arrest the president again after his short-lived martial law declaration in December. BBC World Service. You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. Now, the BBC has been told of safety failings on board an Egyptian dive boat that sank last November, killing more than 10 people. Egyptian authorities have previously blamed the disaster on a massive wave. Our correspondent Joe Inwood has been speaking to several dozen survivors, including one woman who spent 35 hours trapped in an air pocket.
This is what it sounds like, trapped inside the hull of a slowly sinking ship. The footage you can hear was filmed by Luciana Galetta and her partner Christoph, 4 hours in to a 35-hour ordeal. Our things are coming back to us, Christoph says, as their possessions float by. The experience still haunts Luciana.
I was ready to die. And for me, to be honest, it's very weird to be alive. Compared to the others.
She was one of the very last people to be rescued from the Sea Story, a luxury dive boat that sank in Egypt's Red Sea. To see it before the disaster, it looks luxurious. Four stories high with polished decks, there's even a jacuzzi. But on the morning of the 25th of November, it went down in just minutes. We've interviewed nearly a dozen survivors who, for the first time, have spoken of the terror of that night. Hisora Gonzalez describes the moment the ship went down.
All of a sudden, it went bang. My bed was in the wall, and my friend Christian was on top of me. I was really disorientated, so I couldn't find the lights. My friend starts shouting at me, saying, run, run, get out, get out.
Justin Hodges was just down the hall from Hisora and helped lift other passengers to safety once he'd escaped his own cabin.
I didn't realize that the whole boat at that point was already on its side and there was water gushing in the room.
Hisora managed to make it into the water, but she didn't have a life jacket.
Everything was pitch black. The sky was black. The sea was black. We remember looking at the boat and the boat kept sinking and we just screamed, swim away from the boat.
Hisora, Justin and 18 others managed to escape the boat before it was fully submerged. Luciana was one of 16 who did not.
We didn't hear any boat. We didn't hear anyone. We didn't hear anything, not even another helicopter. So I was just wondering how I would prefer to die. To drown, because I would try to get out of this boat. Or if I needed to wait to be thirsty and hungry, I was ready to die.
She would spend 35 hours sitting on fuel tanks before local divers braved the wreck.
Oh my God, it's so dangerous.
Speaking shortly after, the Egyptian authorities were quick to blame a wave.
Oh my God.
But what you can hear now is footage from just hours before the sinking of the Sea Story. It was taken after one of the small boats slipped off the back and clearly shows relatively small waves. This footage, plus the testimony of the 11 survivors we spoke to, cast doubt on the official narrative. One of the voices you can hear is Sarah Martin, a doctor from Lancashire. She ended up in the water alongside Justin and Hisora.
When we were in the water, the waves weren't so big that, you know, we weren't able to swim in them or anything like that. So it's not like it was extremely stormy or anything that seemed highly unusual with the conditions. So it does leave us wondering, you know, why that boat sank.
Dr. Simon Boxall is an oceanographer at the University of Southampton.
I've had a look at the available data for that region for wind conditions, and there is no way that a large wave would have caused the vessel to capsize. That really then boils down to two options: either a navigator error or an error in the design of the vessel. The chances are it could be a combination of both.
In total, 11 people are thought to have died. Neither the Egyptian government nor the company who owned the boat responded to our detailed questions. But it's understood there has been a tightening of the rules governing dive boats in the last few weeks. If lessons have been learned, they have come at a very heavy price.
That was the BBC's Joe Inwood reporting. Now, more high winds are threatening to rekindle some of the fires that have devastated the hills and suburbs of Los Angeles, killing at least 24 people and changing the face of what is the United States' second biggest city. Foreign assistance has been key to getting the fires under control in the past few days, and Canadian planes, so-called super scoopers, have become famous for their technique of collecting seawater at speed to dump on blazes. I've been speaking to the pilot of one of those planes, whose name is Pascal Duclos. He's from Quebec.
We have a two scoop going out of the belly of the plane, and we scoop out of the reservoir, lake, or even the ocean. And Palisade Fire, we've been using the ocean. We've been scooped out of the ocean, and with all the wind we have there, it's really lots of turbulence around the mountain around here.
And it must completely change the handling of the plane if it has the weight of the water in it and when it doesn't.
It's hard on the plane with all the wind we have here with the turbulence. And when we drop the water, we have to exit the canyon we have here. So sometimes it takes full power to get out of the canyon with the winds we have and downdraft and turbulence.
Plus, it must be a very different terrain for you in that it's densely populated.
Yeah, it's really different from what we have in Quebec. Quebec is mainly on a bush when we fight fire with a tree. Here it's on the steepy hill, and it's a brush fire who goes grow really fast, especially with the wind we have last week. It's more difficult because most likely about the terrain here, and they have like power lines all over the place. They have a tower, and because there's a lot of people in the area here, so and even they have a house. So when the house burning, it's black heavy smoke. So it reduces the visibility around, and with the wind, the propagation was really really fast here.
There was a difficult moment at the end of last week when one of your planes was hit by a drone, wasn't there? What happened?
Yeah, we've been scooping out of the ocean close by the Palisade. And we realized after the 2 hour and 40 minutes mission, we had a drone. When we get back, our technician just realized we have a hole on the left wing of the plane of Quebec 243. We was number one these days, so the technician told us they have a hole on the left wing. So we have to ground the plane for 3 days. But it's just back in line a few minutes ago. So we are back in line with the team of two scoopers here right now.
What do you think of these fires, and how do they compare with blazes that you've dealt with before?
It's not the first time we get the Santana wind. It's a kind of a common heaven here, but it's the first time it was like that strong for me. And when we took off from the tanker base here, Van Nuys, we look at the weather station called 69 Bravo, and it was 63 knots of wind on the top of the hill. So on the canyon, with the venturi effect, that can goes up to 70, maybe more than that. So that was the thing was unusual here.
Are there more planes coming from Quebec?
Yeah, we have two more planes. They're going to get ready probably today or tomorrow, depending on the weather. We need to do a pre-flight test. And the target is to send the plane tomorrow, if the weather permits. And we're going to get in Van Nuys as soon as 2 days. We still have to manage the weather to come here.
Pascal Duclos, a Canadian pilot of one of the so-called super scooper planes who's been dousing the fires in Los Angeles. BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Alex Ritson, and on the Global News podcast, we're following reports a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza is at last within reach. We're told a draft text is being studied by negotiators from both sides in Qatar, although there is still no shortage of sceptics. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Spain is planning to impose a tax of up to 100% on properties bought by foreigners from outside the EU. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said the measure, which could especially affect British buyers, was needed to help the country's tackle the country's housing crisis. Guy Hedgeco is our correspondent in Madrid. I asked him what exactly the government was proposing.
Well, what we know so far is what the Prime Minister has said, which is that the idea would be that non-residents from outside the European Union who purchase properties in Spain would have to pay a tax of up to 100% on the value of that property. So obviously that's potentially a very large amount of money. Mr. Sanchez himself said that in 2023 there are around 27,000 such purchases made by non-EU non-residents. So he seems to think that this is quite a substantial part of the housing market. The government website has given a little bit more detail, saying that this is a policy which is in place in some other countries. It talks about Denmark and Canada having similar policies in place. So it clearly doesn't think it's totally outlandish to introduce this policy.
And that's by no means a foregone conclusion, is it?
No, it's not. Now, the opposition Conservatives say that the government is being far too interventionist in the housing market. But, on the other hand, there are also parliamentary allies of Mr. Sanchez further to his left. He's a socialist and he has allies to his left. And some of those allies say he doesn't go far enough with his interventionism in the market. So I think it's going to be quite difficult for him to get this through Congress. It's not necessarily impossible, but it's going to be a pretty tough challenge for him.
I suppose just the government talking about a measure like this could dampen interest among foreign buyers.
I think that's what a lot of people are wondering about, because foreign buyers make up a large part of the housing market, and specifically this will affect foreign buyers from outside the European Union. Now, the biggest single foreign community who buy property in Spain are the British. Moroccans, for example, also buy a lot of property in Spain. So there are concerns in that sense that, you know, this could have a significant impact on the housing market in Spain. Now, the government feels that that impact would be positive in the long term, but there are others who are wondering about that and feel it may just be too drastic.
Developed economies all over the world might be looking at Spain and getting ideas, given the global housing crisis.
Yes, I mean, Spain is by no means the only country in Europe or in the world seeing this kind of crisis, whereby many people, especially young people, are being priced out of the housing market, in particular when it comes to rental. So I think there'll be a lot of other countries, not just around Europe, but around the world, who'll be looking at Spain and how it progresses with these measures and to see whether or not they work.
The BBC's Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. There have been many false dawns on the path to a ceasefire in Gaza, but after 15 months of a war that has killed tens of thousands and has had big repercussions around the world, what's been happening today in Qatar was described as the final round of peace talks. The host said the big differences had been overcome between Israel and Hamas, and a draft agreement did now exist for a cessation of violence. Here's Majid Al-Ansari, the Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesman.
So the main reason why we are more optimistic right now is, as I said, you know, during the past months there were underlying issues, major issues between the two parties unresolved. These issues were resolved during the talks in the past couple of weeks, and therefore we have reached a point where the major issues that were preventing a deal from happening were addressed, and we have language pertaining to these issues that has been distributed between both parties. We especially appreciate the roles of both the Biden administration and the incoming Trump administration in the talks in the past couple of weeks.
But he also had the warning that the deal was not yet a reality. Mr. Ansari added that the two sides could still get lost in the details.
It's a very critical moment. It can be the happiest moment, but it can be also the worst. We're just praying and asking the whole world to sign, to do it, just to do it. We have to make sure this tragedy is finished.
That was Hadas Calderon, whose ex-husband, Ofer Calderon, is among the hostages. She's in Tel Aviv, anxiously waiting to see if there will be a deal. The BBC's Jonah Fisher is in Jerusalem. I asked him what was holding things up.
Well, what we are being briefed by pretty much all sides who are involved around these talks in Qatar is that the big issues have been largely resolved, and now they're really into the nitty-gritty. I was on a call with an Israeli government spokesperson this afternoon. They were talking about hundreds and thousands of little details which have to be ironed out. Remember, as part of this agreement, there are all sorts of phased steps in the process in terms of releases of hostages, pullbacks from certain areas, specific locations in Gaza where, for example, the Israeli military will move its resources to. So all of those sort of tiny details are, we believe, having to be ironed out at the moment. And though there is this sense that that the process is now closer to an agreement than it has ever been since this war started in October of 2023, there are still things which have to be resolved. And until they are resolved, nothing has been agreed.
A long-term plan for the governance of Gaza is still to be drawn up. But presumably there is an idea for when the Israeli military will withdraw, is there?
Well, it's complicated. The deal is seen as having three phases, but effectively only the first phase is being negotiated in great detail. Talks for the second phase will begin during the first phase. So at the moment, the deal is for a ceasefire that would last 42 days. And during that period, there would be a phased release of hostages. And in return, Israel would release Palestinian prisoners, possibly dozens for every hostage that is released. Israeli forces would, during that 42-day period, pull back from the more densely populated parts of Gaza to buffer areas, but they would remain within Gaza, and aid would be allowed to flow in much greater quantities than is going in at the moment. But there are question marks as to what then happens next. Not all the hostages will be released in this first phase if all goes according to plan. Men who are of military age and are being held will still be part of the second phase negotiations. And as part of that second phase as well will be those discussions about what will happen in Gaza in terms of security. Will Israel remain with a presence there? And then moving on to the even more complicated question of, okay, so if Israel pulls out, who is going to run Gaza? Who's going to operate it? Who's going to be put in charge? Israel, of course, has made it very clear that it doesn't want Hamas to be part of that. So in a sense, they've put the sort of more easier part of the process, which has still been very hard to get to, as part of this phase one, and that would see the fighting stop. But then the really difficult questions about Gaza, about its more long-term future, about what Israel sees its role being in relation to Gaza, that's all been pushed down the line. And only if we get an agreement in place on the first part of it will talks then move steadily into thinking about the next phases.
The BBC's Jonah Fisher there. In Jerusalem, will the anticipated ceasefire and hostage release deal seems to be an example of the outgoing Biden and incoming Trump administrations working together. Dana Stroll was Assistant US Deputy Secretary of Defense for the Middle East under President Biden until just over a year ago. She's now Director of Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I asked her, were the two US sides working well together?
Absolutely. And I think it's quite remarkable. This is, if you think through the campaign, both Biden and then Harris and Trump, the accusations of weak Biden foreign policy and irresponsible Trump America alone foreign policy were really a strong element of the rhetoric from the two camps. But when it comes to a ceasefire in Gaza and getting the remaining hostages out, politics have clearly been set aside. We have members of the Biden team working with members of the incoming Trump team, traveling together, holding meetings together. And it is putting life, both Palestinian lives for Gaza and a flow of humanitarian aid, and also the remaining Israelis in Gaza as the first priority.
We've been hearing the framework of this deal. It's pretty much identical to what was proposed last May. The real difference is the Trump presidency deadline, isn't it? So he'll be able to claim the credit.
I think no matter what, Trump is going to claim the credit. But there are really significant developments that happened since last May. And you're absolutely right. The main elements of the agreement are the same. But here's what's different. U.S. military support, political and diplomatic backing for Israel really never wavered over the final year of the Biden administration. And it was under President Biden's watch that Israel was able to decimate Hezbollah, defend itself twice from Iranian air attacks, ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and suicide drones, and Israel targeting Iran inside Iranian territory twice, the most recent one in the fall, taking out all of Iran's strategic air defense. So Iran is weaker and more vulnerable today than it has ever been. It's lost Hamas in Gaza. It's lost Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's lost its state partner, Bashar al-Assad, in Damascus. The strategic table is completely reset and Hamas is alone. And I think those dynamics are why the ceasefire agreement is more likely today than it has been in the past.
The U.S. Secretary of State said a few hours ago at the Atlantic Council that he had a plan for rebuilding and governing Gaza, not that he will be able to implement it. It included Palestinian statehood. What do we know about how the Trump administration views the future of Gaza and the West Bank?
Well, in the first Trump administration, his team put out what it called the deal of a century, and it included a roadmap for a Palestinian state and some Israeli annexation over parts of the West Bank. And neither the Israelis or the Palestinians supported that agreement at that period, that moment in time. What we know about the Trump team this time is people like his nominee to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, believes that the West Bank is part of Israel. And so I think some of the signaling here is that you're going to have a Trump national security team that's going to be much more open to having talks with Israel about what annexation of at least aspects of the West Bank look like. And that is not necessarily consistent with how we've traditionally thought about a two-state outcome.
That was Dana Stroll, formerly of the Biden administration. A two-day operation to get gold miners out of an abandoned shaft south of Johannesburg in South Africa has resulted in the rescue of more than 200 people, but many are feared dead underground, and those that made it out alive are weak, emaciated, and likely now to face prosecution because the miners were working illegally. They were effectively starved out by the authorities. The BBC's Myony Jones is at the site of the mine in Stilfontein. She told me earlier about the state the miners were in when they emerged.
We saw dozens of them being pulled out of the mine today. Some were too weak to walk on their own. They had to be assisted by emergency services. Others looked incredibly emaciated, ribs and shoulder blades sticking out. So they're receiving medical care at the moment. But the authorities were keen to emphasize that these miners are illegal, and as such, they do plan to prosecute them.
And it isn't clear, is it, how many of these miners were trapped underground, or the extent to which they weren't willing to come out for fear of prosecution by the authorities?
Absolutely, yeah. The police here has launched this new operation, and the idea is that a number of disused mines, of mines without owners, would be sealed, but also that anybody found mining illegally, a kind of tough approach would be taken against them. So in the case of the Stilfontein mine, initially they refused to send down any food or water for the miners. They did also, apparently according to trade unions, close some of the entrances, which made it more difficult for the miners to come out. A number of them were able to escape, but others couldn't and ended up being too weak because of the lack of food or water to do that. So this approach has been criticized by rights groups. They say, granted, these men were acting illegally, but they do have a right to being treated humanely. And they argue that they should have been rescued earlier and then prosecuted.
And these victims of what is an official policy of being starved out, are they commanding public sympathy?
It's a very difficult situation. I think it's fair to say that the public doesn't have much sympathy for them. They see them as criminals. Also, an additional layer to this story is that many of them are illegal migrants from neighbouring countries. So they aren't necessarily viewed with much sympathy by the wider public. But the argument that's been made by rights group is, regardless of the fact that they're criminals, or even if they're foreign nationals, everybody should be treated humanely and everybody should get the chance to face justice without necessarily having to go through the torturous process which these men have had to go through over the last 2 months.
It's possible, isn't it, that there could be many more underground, possibly hundreds of deaths could happen here?
Absolutely. The videos emerged on Monday showing rows and rows of what appears to be dead bodies on the ground wrapped in plastic. We certainly saw a number of bodies being loaded into trucks today. Some of these body bags seem so light that the rescue workers were carrying them by themselves. So either the bodies had decomposed for a long time or they were from people who were very emaciated and very light. So there are concerns. We spoke to relatives who are like, they're desperate for their relatives to come out sooner rather than later. Even though food and water is being sent down the mine shaft as they're bringing people up, they're still concerned that their relatives, some of whom are sick, could be in real danger here.
The BBC's Myonee Jones speaking to me earlier from Stilfontein in South Africa. I'm Paul Henley and this is NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Ukraine says it's carried out its biggest strikes yet on Russian territory. Kiev said they included a successful attack on a chemical plant in the Bryansk region where shells and cruise missile components are reportedly made, and an oil refinery in Saratov. New Russian tactics in this war are being discovered as well. Moscow is using Ukrainian prisoners of war to force their families back in Ukraine to carry out sabotage acts. The BBC has seen evidence that Russia is making threats to worried relatives. Ukrainian officials say around half of all prisoners' families have been approached by Russian agents. Will Vernon reports.
Under arrest, arsonists. Another plot foiled, say Ukraine's security services. Saboteurs recruited by Russia to set fire to military vehicles and railway lines. Many do it for money, paid by suspected Russian agents. But others are motivated by the desperation of waiting for loved ones in captivity.
A Ukrainian number called me. I picked up and he introduced himself as Dmitry.
Svetlana hadn't heard from her husband, Dima, for more than 2 years when she received a strange phone call.
He spoke with a Russian accent. He said, if you want your husband to come home sooner, I can help.
Dima, an army medic, had been captured not long after the full-scale invasion. The man on the phone, Dmitry, said he could arrange for Svetlana to speak to her husband or even organize an early release for him. But there was a price.
He said, I must either set fire to a military facility, a car, or a railway electrical box. The other option was to reveal the location of air defense systems nearby.
Svetlana reported the call to the security service, who told her she should try and buy for time while they investigated. So she played along, pretending to agree to torch a nearby railway facility. She managed to record some of the calls.
Pour in a liter of the fluid and add a bit of petrol. Go to some sort of railway junction. Make sure there are no security cameras and wear a hat, just in case.
The security service then told Svetlana the calls were coming from inside Russia and she should refuse to cooperate further.
And then the threats began. He said they'd kill my husband. For days he kept calling, saying, your husband is being tortured and it's your fault.
Did you at any point consider going through with it?
No, not for a second. My husband never would have forgiven me if I had done something like that.
In a statement to the BBC, the Security Service of Ukraine said it has thwarted numerous attempts by Russian intelligence to recruit relatives of Ukrainian prisoners of war. They say those who report approaches will be treated as victims, but anyone agreeing to work with Russia can be charged with treason. Petro Yatsenko is from the Headquarters for the Treatment of Prisoners of War, part of Ukrainian military intelligence. They issue advice to families on what to do when approached.
They're in a very vulnerable position and some of them are ready to do anything, but of course we are working to educate them. In general, it's very minor damage for Ukrainian armed forces, but it can destabilize the Ukrainian society's unity. So it's a main problem. And of course, in case someone is going to share the location of, for example, air defense system, it's a big problem for us too.
In a statement, the Russian authorities denied allegations that prisoners' families are used by Russia as leverage and accused Ukraine of coercing people to commit sabotage in Russian territory. Back in her flat, Svetlana and husband Dima are enjoying time with Vova, their four-year-old son. Dima was released from captivity in September. He says the Russians didn't follow through with their threats to harm him. But with thousands of Ukrainians still in captivity, some could go to extreme lengths to bring their loved ones home.
That report from the BBC's Will Vernon. Finally on the programme today, Anthony Blunt, a British art historian and surveyor of the Queen's pictures, meaning he oversaw the Royal Art Collection, confessed in 1964 that he'd been a Soviet agent since the 1930s. However, the Queen wasn't fully informed for another 9 years, according to files just released by Britain's domestic MI5 spy agency via the National Archives. Professor Oliver Buckton is the author of Counterfeit Spies, How World War II Intelligence Operations Shaped Cold War Spy Fiction. So why are we more familiar with the spy names of Philby, Burgess and McLean, less so with that of Anthony Blunt?
Oh, I think it was partly for his personality. He was rather withdrawn and, a mysterious figure. Even his friends didn't really know him. He didn't search out publicity in the way that, say, Guy Burgess did. But also, I think because of the fact he was only revealed publicly in 1979, so it wasn't, it was sort of kept separate to some extent from the other members of the Cambridge spy ring, but still a very important Soviet agent.
What did he do for the Soviets, and why was the nature of his work covered up for so long?
So during World War II, he was recruited by MI5, the security service, and that gave him access to all kinds of intelligence, such as Enigma, the Enigma codes, and other top secret intelligence, which he passed on to the Soviet Union. But, you know, other cases of cover-up included Kim Philby, who was perhaps even a more important Soviet agent, who wasn't arrested and eventually defected to Moscow. So I think, you know, as an establishment figure, part of the royal you know, household, the royal family to some extent, you know, there was a reason why his espionage and treason were kept secret for many years.
Because they were ashamed of him being so high up in the establishment?
Yeah, because it was a huge embarrassment that someone who had been, you know, a surveyor of the king's pictures and then the queen's pictures since 1945 had at the same time, since the 1930s, been a Soviet agent. But we have to remember that in the 1930s, the Soviet Union was seen as the last sort of, you know, bulwark against fascism. And during World War II, they were obviously Britain's allies. And so the whole complexion of treason against Britain, treason, you know, for the Soviet Union changed dramatically after World War II during the Cold War, when Soviet Union was now, you know, the bête noire of the Western democracy. So
many
it
thanks.
Became much more sinister after that.
Professor Oliver Buckton, that was NewsHour. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye for now.
Hi, I'm Alex Ritson, and on the Global News podcast, we're following reports a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza is at last within reach. We're told a draft text is being studied by negotiators from both sides in Qatar, although there is still no shortage of sceptics. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.